morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Beth Gunn on behalf of Ryan Hyams as the representative of the State of California pursuant to the Private Attorneys General Act, and on behalf of objecting class members Trent Andrews, Cynthia Cardenas, Victoria Cosio, and Elizabeth Garcia. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal, and I will attempt to watch the clock. The first point I'd like to make is that reversal in this case is proper on the basis of the one central issue that that has just been discussed here. The fact that the settlement seeks to release PAGA claims that plaintiffs had no authority to settle because they had not complied with PAGA's statutory pre-filing notice requirements that were required to pursue those claims. We're asking this court to adopt a bright-line rule that it is an abuse of discretion for a district court to approve unauthorized PAGA settlements like this one. This is what the California California Appellate Court did in the Uribe case. In Uribe,
Uribe's facts were much different, right? So could you go to this point where for me, this is the rub. You want a bright line rule, but there, under Muniz, for example, if we were to go with this claim preclusion sort of line of reasoning that the district court endorsed, or at least predicted maybe, then there's going to be a question, really, about the extent to which the claims really do arise out of the particular the specifics that were included in the notice. So how do we get to a bright line rule?
Well, I think the
bright line would be the ones reaching that rule as opposed to the California Supreme Court.
So I think the California Supreme Court has actually already created this bright line rule. It has stated, going as far back as Arias, that unless a party complies with the notice provisions, it cannot proceed with that claim.
That's why you don't need it from us. That's what I keep saying. We've already got that. But then the devil's in the details, right, about what the extent to which the claim was really fairly read into that notice. That's
correct.
What we're trying to grapple with.
Correct. And I think our position has been from the very beginning that the Hyams-only claims are distinct, different kinds of claims. They are claims that were not noticed. Those labor code provisions were not included. They are different kinds of claims than the kinds of claims that were brought in the Cabrera case or the Chelian case.
Are they different or just a subset?
They are different. They are entirely different. They are not a subset. We have argued extensively. They do not fall under the claim preclusion analysis. They are not. They do not arise from the same nucleus of operative fact. They are entirely different. The maximum pharmacy hours of work claim. Those are about whether they're standalone claims, first of all, for which there's no individual private right of action. So there's no individual, you know, claim that can be brought on to seek relief for those claims. They are meant to prohibit exceeding certain hours of work in the workplace, and they have nothing to do with whether or not somebody was paid overtime, whether or not somebody worked off the clock. It has to do with on-the-clock work. And the measure of damages would be to look at the on-the-clock time records, which no one in this case ever looked at. There were no facts alleged in the PAGA letters about any of this. In fact, their claims were all about off-the-clock work and reasons why people didn't take their rest breaks and things like and meal breaks and things like that. It had nothing to do with these very strict hours that are supposed to be enforced.
I must have misunderstood something about exclusivity of PAGA claims. If there's a state law that says you can't cause people to work more than a certain number of hours and an employer requires them to work more than the permitted hours, there's no private right of action. It can only be done through a PAGA claim.
So in this particular case, this is I'm talking about Labor Code Sections 850 and 851. They regulate the hours that people who sell at retail drugs and medicine are allowed to work.
Yeah, and I thought if somebody worked too many hours, that the person who worked too many hours would be entitled to bring just a solo claim to get paid for those hours, but he can't, huh?
If he didn't get paid for those hours, that's a different claim than if he worked those hours and got paid for them, but they were in excess of what the state said were appropriate hours.
Now I understand.
That's the distinction that I think you're looking for. So It's our position that those claims are distinct claims. They have nothing to do with any of the facts or the theories or the labor code provisions that were identified in the settling parties' original PACA letters. So those claims, there's no greater right of a state proxy than to resolve claims.
District courts, also have an imperative to try to get litigation concluded, as you appreciate. And I think this has been ongoing for something this Chalian, what I'll call Chalian Cabrera, had been ongoing for something like 4 years. Did the district court have the option, given their settlement agreement, to sever the three claims that you're talking about?
The district court did not have the option to approve the settlement and sever those claims, but the district court did have the option at preliminary approval, and this we specifically requested this at the preliminary approval hearing. The district court had the option to say, I will not approve a settlement that overreaches in this manner, that includes these claims.
Does that mean, maybe my question wasn't artful, but I'm not sure what is different from what you're saying and what I've asked, so I probably didn't do a good job. Did the district court have the ability, given this settlement agreement, to say that if I won't approve unless or until those are severed?
The district court did have the ability to say that, yes. The district court could have said, and we actually requested this, and the district court did not grant us that relief, but we said, look, we don't need to be talking about a lot of these things if the district court severs these claims, because the PAGA only claims, the HIAMS only claims, they're the problem here. That's the big overreach. Those are the things that were never part of these cases.
When you say that, you mean the three, not the 13.
I mean the three, yes. There were other claims that do overlap. They were different, and those are not the primary basis that we think. Okay.
So there were 10 PAGA claims that were overlapping from the start, and then three that were added at the end. That's what we're fighting over.
It was actually five claims, but it's three types of claims. So the HIAMS only claims, there were five claims that were added, and they fall into three different categories: the pharmacy maximum hours of work, the day of rest, and the. Okay.
So grading was not helpful to just answer Judge Bumate's question, which I think would be helpful to all of
yes.
the plaintiffs, if you could.
So if I'm understanding your question properly, I believe there were overlapping claims that we knew that were overlapping,
yeah,
that were exhausted.
How many were there?
Does 10 sound right?
It sounds a little high, but it could be 10. It was at least five.
Okay.
I can get it for you. So there were at least five overlapping claims, and then these additional five claims were added. But
added? Finish.
They were added at the time of the settlement. They were added as a function of settlement.
As a complaint.
Correct.
Yes, thank you. In July.
So I guess the answer is if they didn't add those three claims, then you would have no argument about timeliness or anything like that, because complete overlap, they have a right to sue, settle the PAGA claims.
I think that's correct. The triggering event was the addition of those claims.
Okay.
Typically, if we were going to have a timely analysis, I would expect the district court to talk about the reason and length of the delay, and I didn't see that.
There was no timeliness analysis in the intervention motion.
Different question. Did he analyze the reason and length of delay, which is a component of the timeliness analysis? I don't see it.
In the intervention decision, the court did not analyze that.
I'm sorry for this constant overlap. These cases inevitably...
I understand, and I was at the trial court level, so I can perhaps fill in the blanks here. And I would also like to note, in response to the court's earlier inquiry, regarding the hearing in March, that was a hearing in which, as counsel in the HIAMS case, discovery requests had been made, and we fought and fought and fought. We finally got it teed up to a magistrate.
You're going over this quickly, but in my notes, this was interesting to me because there's a representation in the course of this advocacy that nobody had reached out. But my understanding is that there was the reason for that conversation at the December, I think, 18th hearing is that there's an outstanding discovery request from HIAMS counsel to CVS. I don't know which CVS.
That's correct.
Like, now I've lost track of them. Asking specifically, is there a settlement court out there that would impact our claims?
That's correct.
When was that discovery? Here's what I don't know. When was that discovery promulgated?
It was propounded in more than a year earlier. It was propounded. We fought. We met and conferred. We went back and forth over what would be.
You answered my question a year earlier.
Yes.
Opposing counsel have an opportunity to respond if they want to.
Yes. Also, the CVS was obligated to file a notice of related cases in these matters and did not. And we always interpreted the fact that CVS did not alert the parties in the Chilean or the Cabrera cases as evidence of the fact that it intended to engineer a reverse auction.
So could you get back to the settlement?
Yes.
And Moniz, I think Moniz didn't exist yet at the time of this district court.
That's correct.
But he seemed to have predicted it accurately. In what ways does this opinion differ, this ruling, in your case, differ from Moniz?
Well, in our case, it's different from Moniz in that we're talking a lot about the Hyams-only claim, so there is no overlap of the claim. So that's one difference. And in Moniz, it recognizes the right of a state proxy to interfere in another case because of the state's interest. And it's been our position all along that the district court was supposed to look at the deterrent effect of a PAGA settlement. And PAGA is different than class settlements in that way. And there's a different standard that should have been employed. But
your position on whether we should wait for Turrieta?
I agree with what my co-counsel, Ms. Sperling, said, in that Turrieta could easily contain some guidance for this court that would be useful, but I do not think that it addresses the core thing that is different about this case.
Another question presented in Turrieta, so I appreciate that.
Yeah. I agree with what she has already stated about that.
Is it the case that the settlement gives only $75,000 to the PAGA claim?
That's correct. Sure. Yeah, that's correct. And that's something that I wanted to discuss. There's 25,000 approximately aggrieved employees. That comes out to less than 76 cents per aggrieved employee, and it's less than 3 cents per pay period that is at issue. These are for claims that counsel in the Chilean and Cabrera cases did not investigate, did not know what they did not evaluate. They did.
Why does that matter? That's not the nature of a PAGA claim. It's not
right.
To recompense.
Not
like
damages.
Right.
It's deterrent effect.
Right.
And if CVS is selling out a claim that in the Hyams case is pending for tens of millions of dollars and getting a settlement for $75,000, that to me sounds like a reverse auction.
But counsel, I don't think you're really getting to Judge Bumate's point. You've done this sort of per person, per capita analysis, and it's not a damages component, right? It's a penalty. Yes, that's not disputed.
It's a penalty component. That's correct. It's for civil penalties. And I think the point is that it doesn't create a deterrent effect for CVS to wrap in, to sell it so cheaply.
Too small to deter.
It does not. It's too small to deter.
Well, but that's because it's $75,000, not because of the per person. But fine. I think you've answered the question. Okay. I think we're missing something.
I think my point is pennies on the dollar. CVS is a huge corporation with billions and billions of revenue and profits every year, and pennies on the dollar for pay periods. I mean, our argument has always been CVS doesn't want to comply with the labor code. It instead pays counsel after the fact, and that's its compliance mechanism. We had class members who submitted declarations to this effect. CVS does this over and over again. We get a small check, and then nothing changes. And then a couple years later, we get another small check. There has been no deterrent effect. We made that argument, and the district court ignored it.
We understand now. I think we're just being too literal. We get it.
Okay, so.
So can you address the Callahan question? Like, why are you even allowed to be here?
So I think you're talking about the question of standing.
Correct. Standing.
Right. So I believe that we have appellate standing because this falls under the exceptional circumstances doctrine, and we argued it in our briefs, but the law in this circuit is that non-parties do have appellate standing under certain circumstances, and then exceptional circumstances apply when a party has participated in the lower court proceedings and when the judgment at issue intends to bind them. And there's no doubt that those two factors exist here, and we believe that that provides us with the standing that we're required as a non-party.
What was the participation below? What was your participation below?
We participated heavily by objecting to the settlement, and there have been several courts that have said that that type of objection is the type of participation in the lower court that would enable one to seek standing under the exceptional circumstances doctrine.
Happened in Callahan?
That is not what Callahan was about.
I'll take your word for it, but
Callahan did not at all. There was no issue in Callahan as to whether or not the exceptional circumstances doctrine applied. There was no analysis of that. The parties did not argue it. It was not part of the Callahan case.
Oh, okay. So you're asking us to yeah.
We're asking you to move beyond Callahan. Callahan is a ruling in one aspect, but then there's another doctrine of exceptional circumstances.
Can you cite me a case that shows that if you object below to the settlement, that's enough to get the exceptional circumstances?
The case that we cite in our brief, there are several of them. One of them was Buffin. Buffin was one of the main cases. There is also the In Re Estate of Ferdinand Marcus, human rights litigation, and Commodity Futures Trading Commission versus Topworth. Those are all cases in which a non-party was deemed to have standing under the exceptional circumstances doctrine, and specifically when they formally objected to the court's order and participated in the hearing.
Did you want to save time?
I did. Thank you.
Sorry. If in the previous case, if we were to find that the district court erred by rejecting the mandatory intervention, what should we do with your case?
There are several options, I think. One thing is to say that you could also rule on the issues in our case if you want to reverse it. And if you want to say that the settlement was unfair or inadequate, which is one of the things that we've argued. In addition to that, we could just go back as an intervener and then, we would have the right to be involved in the case and to settle the case and settle the claims that we should have been involved in from the very beginning.
That'd be preferable than a filing as a non-party objector, right? As an intervener.
Yeah, we believe as an intervener, we would have the right to settle, to be involved in the settlement of those claims, and that's what we wanted all along. Those were the Hyams only claims. Only Hyams should be the one to settle them. It shouldn't be anybody else.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me briefly address the appellate standing issue. There are no exceptional circumstances here. As this court has recognized in Ferd Volkoff versus Janssen Pharmaceutica, exceptional circumstances usually means a party is hailed into a case against their will and has an adverse judgment entered against them. In this case,
why isn't this just that? I mean, Hyams is being brought in against his will, and he objects to what amounts to a judgment against them because it sets up res judicata against him.
So, because the LWA was given notice of this and didn't respond, if the LWA below had objected to the settlement, I would agree that's exceptional circumstances. In that case, it's like one of the cases cited, which
you're saying the state agency can object, but not the guy who's carrying the state agency's water as its official representative?
A little bit more nuanced. What I'm saying is for the exceptional circumstances to truly mean exceptional circumstances, the state of California itself, who gets notice of the settlement, should be the one to say, I think it's unfair. We object.
They've already said, we don't have the personnel for this. We just farm it out to private attorneys general. That's what PAGA means. And those private attorneys general are acting as representatives of the state in this.
But if every time one private attorney general believes another is acting inadequately, and that creates appellate standing, then it would swallow the rule of exceptional. And I would at least note that there are several cases out there recently where the LWDA has
done this. Attorney General that had gone through the notice steps and been authorized on behalf of the PAGA claims in this case.
Well, we believe that we did provide that notice. We certainly provided settlement. We provided the Second Amendment consolidated complaint. They also had our original PAGA notices. They had everything at the time of settlement, if they wanted to object this, all the information they needed to see whether or not this was a fair and reasonable settlement. And I guess what I'm stressing is in cases like, and there was a recent case, Acevedo versus Cash Call, and we're going to provide a Rule 28J letter on that very soon, in which
we know that they were not at the table when the settlement was negotiated.
They
and if they'd said, yeah, we want to be at the table, they would have been allowed to be.
I mean,
for all we know, the whole thing would have taken place behind their back, even if they were knocking on the door of the conference room.
So I just dispute that we were trying to do this behind their back, because, again, when you send them a settlement agreement, you send them a second amended consolidated complaint, which we didn't even have to do. The statute only requires the original.
This is a tough argument for
sure.
I've gone over the bullet points in the timeline in detail, and there's a really long delay there, it seems to me, where they didn't have notice. And besides, it is what it is in terms of do you have a different bullet point in the timeline that I need to
Yeah, well, I'm trying to say the final approval hearing was in December of 2020. They had 6 months before the settlement agreement and the second amended consolidated complaint.
They moved to intervene the day.
Oh, I'm talking about the LWDA. I wasn't talking. I'm sorry.
But that's why I'm saying it's a tough argument for you, for the reasons that Judge Kleinfeld is mentioning, right? There's a statutory scheme whereby I think California courts have been very, very clear. Whoever gets deputized is the one representing the state's interests. And Now you seem to be saying that, but in spite of that, that you would expect that the client, in this case the state, would be obligated to be the one to object.
Yeah, the whole purpose of providing the settlements to the LWDA directly is so the LWDA itself, not the co-plaintiffs, there's actually no requirements for us to send a settlement agreement to Himes Council, even if we knew about them.
Right, but you're getting to Judge Kleinfeld's question now, which is, you know, the whole premise of the PAGA statute is that it's an overworked agency. The legislature said they're not going to be able to do what we want to deputize and incentivize, and so... What about that? That's his question.
I understand, and there's many courts that have decided these issues based on the fact that the LWDA has not responded. While that might be the practical reality, the purpose of the statutory scheme is you provide a settlement agreement, and the idea is the LWDA is the one to protect the interest by reviewing it. Whether or not they're adequately staffed or not is a state issue, and I believe they should be staffed more. But in terms of the consequences of that,
private attorneys general.
Yes, but with the settlement.
Private attorneys general, and if the letter is sent to the client instead of the client's lawyer, that's not adequate notice when the client is represented by counsel.
But the settlement agreements, the statute only requires to be sent to the LWDA in the court. That is the difference. If the statute had required that we send it to anyone with an overlapping case, then I would agree with your argument. But the statute as written, and we can only go with as written, doesn't require that.
LWDA can't intervene as a right under the statute anyway, right?
I'm not sure about that because, for instance, in Acevedo versus Cash Call, the court invited them to participate, and the DSLE, on behalf of the LWDA, submitted a brief and objected to the settlement. We have a number of cases where the LWDA has either below objected to the settlement by writing in, whether that's intervention or not, I don't know.
That's what I was just going to say. Yeah. To get to Judge Bumate's point, I see them sort of popping up,
right?
Objecting perhaps, but I think the question went to intervention.
So Acevedo uses the term intervention to describe that process. And it is unclear to me under the statute whether or not they can intervene. Whatever it is, they're allowed to object, right? They're allowed to say, we think this is an unfair settlement. If it goes on appeal, right, they can't submit an amicus brief. And they may even have more appellate rights under the theory that I'm trying to outline, which is if the state of California, after receiving a settlement, had objected to the settlement, I think that would be an exceptional circumstance. To have every single PAGA plaintiff who believes another settlement is fair to have appellate standing would just defeat the rule of exceptional circumstances. It happens all the time. We never agree amongst plaintiff lawyers about what a good settlement is and what isn't. We have different views, different experiences, and the person who's always shut out of the settlement has hard feelings. And we didn't want to shut anyone out of the settlement. That's why I joined forces with Mr. Clark's firm. And if I knew about their case and they had picked the phone, I would have joined forces with them.
So that's conceptually the case that PAGA plaintiffs can have overlapping claims all the time, right? They send the same notice to the LWD saying the same facts, cite the same labor code, and anyone can settle those.
That is correct. And that's why it's incumbent upon the plaintiff's counsel to get together earlier and work together. And that's what we wanted to do in this case, and we were deprived of that opportunity. If anyone created a reverse auction situation, it was these individuals who thought somehow they were going to be able to litigate and settle their case around us.
Well, wait a minute. Did you, opposing counsel's just indicated, and I'm for whoever is the right lawyer to respond to this question, that there was an outstanding discovery request for more than a year asking CVS, admittedly asking CVS, is there any settlement afoot? So when you say they're trying to settle out from under you,
well, no, I'm not saying
that's a reach, counsel.
I mean in a different way, which is if you don't join forces early, right? If you think that you can, and we're the first filed case for 10 of the 13 PAGA claims. What is going to happen at some point is the defendant's going to approach the first filed case to settle, right? And I can't account for another case I don't know about.
Opposing counsel's declaration indicates that it was CVS that insisted upon adding these three claims. I have no idea if that's correct, but you can understand why this would be of considerable concern,
right?
Because it threatens to undermine the whole incentive system that the legislature established, right, for these kinds of claims.
Well, and let me talk about those claims. We actually did an analysis of those claims.
I'm missing something on the point I just made. Seem to be pivoting away from it quickly, but if I'm missing
I didn't mean to pivot away from that. No, I understand that CVS is the one that asked for it. The reason they asked for it is because they had a theory, and it turned out to be correct, that if you force someone to work off the clock, as we alleged, or if you allege, like, inadequate staffing in these issues, that those people might work beyond the statutory pharmacist maximum hours. And our expert looked at that issue, and he said, yes, when people work off the clock to this mandatory training, they're going beyond the 9 hours that the legislator prescribes.
Seem to be dropping down to the merits of the claim.
No, all I'm trying to say is because they arise from the same operative facts as the underlying claims, I think it's fair game to settle them. And what I'm trying to also say is that in terms of notice to them, sure, they weren't specifically in there, but a lot of other claims were, and on the factual predicate as is, a settlement could have been reached to reach all claims that arise out of the same facts, the res judicata.
Well, that's where I keep coming back to what I call the target, the devil's in the details about what's going to have been fairly encompassed by the notice. But can I just ask you quickly, do you agree that, well, what's your position on Turrieta, that we should wait? Is it going to help at all?
I don't think Turrieta is going to assist here. I don't think that we need to wait. I think these issues can be decided. For instance, the factual predicate rule is an issue of federal law. It's flexibility provided to...
We're trying to get at the nature of the right, and the question is whether Turrieta would say tell us anything or provide us any clues. Let me ask you a different question.
Sure.
Because I think you fairly answered that, which is we don't know what the California Supreme Court's going to do, and it's going to do whatever it's going to do. But it's fully briefed, right?
That's my understanding.
Yeah, that's my understanding, too. What do you think about opposing counsel's statement that the district court in this case would have had the ability to insist upon severance of those three claims before approving the settlement? Was that an option in this particular settlement agreement?
I don't think so. I'm not aware.
Severance provision?
There's no severance provision that I'm aware of, but I'm also not aware of any authority laws at district court to rewrite a settlement. It's usually a thumbs up or thumbs down. Right. And so the court did, though, at least, and look.
I mean, what I'm posturing is there was a settlement agreement. This district court was very well aware of the allegation that the three claims had been added without having been properly noticed. My question is not a trick question. I'm just wondering if there's anything in the settlement agreement that would have prevented severance, because I'm trying to get at workable rules going forward.
I'm not sure if there's anything in the settlement agreement that would have done it, but the court could always say, I may not approve this if you have those claims.
Right.
Right?
Okay.
And we don't deny that power.
Right. Let me ask you about this notice. Get back to notice for a moment. Your argument is they could have shown up earlier because they knew that the settlement discussions were going on. And the first thought that occurs to me is, suppose somebody knew that a particular couple was getting married. That doesn't mean they can show up and get dinner at the wedding dinner. They have to get an invitation for that. And what I'm thinking is, they might know that settlement discussions are going on. I don't know how they're going to know when the people who are discussing, basically CVS trying to bar as many claims as possible and seeing what it takes to pay the lawyers to agree to that, the lawyers for the plaintiffs. I don't know if they would have known whether they would have been told when the discussions were taking place. I don't know if they'd be allowed into the conference room or lawyer's office where the discussions were taking place. I don't know if they'd be allowed to be heard. So it seems to me like attributing knowledge to them that settlement discussions are going on just isn't worth much. They've got to get invited to participate for it to be worth anything. And it could easily be the case that, no, you guys would upset the whole apple cart. You can't participate.
So to address that, my argument's a little bit different. I never said just knowledge of settlement discussions. It's actually broader. When you know that another case has a substantial overlap with your case, as recognized by this court in Air California and Smith versus March, don't wait, because we may settle the case, and if we settle the case even without those three claims, we're still selling 95% of their cases.
Don't wait. Opposing counsel says there was outstanding discovery request a year earlier. Don't wait. Yeah. Just walk me through. What are they supposed to do right if there's...
Sure. So at the time the notice of related case was filed, that disclosed our case. At that point, they looked up what our case was about and saw that there was substantial overlap between Cabrera and our case.
Was there a notice of related case filed in Hyams?
It was in Hyams' case. They filed a notice.
At that point, is it correct? You said that there was 10 of 10 claims that overlapped at that point.
Correct. Cabrera case has always been a very broad action that substantially overlaps with at least the pharmacy part of their case. Right? And they, instead of reaching out, argued it's not a related case. Which is...
Well, things always change, especially in a pre-certification settlement. At the beginning of the case, the defendant in a possible class action might want the class to be as narrow as possible to keep the dollars down. But once it looks like they're working out a settlement, it's in the defendant's interest to have the class embrace the whole world so that everybody's barred by res judicata.
And to address that exact concern, because I don't want to have the broadest thing possible, when we did the Second Amendment consolidated complaint, all we did was take Chalian and Cabrera and put it into one. We didn't add a single thing other than those claims, which we made clear arose out of the same fact. And it was precisely to address that issue.
You didn't add a single thing.
Other than the claim, factually.
Other than the three claims.
Right. I said
that's her whole point. So that's not.
Right, but again, on the factual predicate, we want to make clear that these claims rise from the same factual predicate. We're doing it consistent with res judicata.
The factual predicate is just a question. Again, it goes back to it's a spectrum. You know, at what level are we talking about? At what level of generality? All people who worked at CVS between, you know, date X and date Y? Surely not. And the question is drill down.
Yeah, and the drill down.
And
yeah.
Did it include? That's what she's gone into some detail about the extent to which the pre-existing authority requires the claim to be properly labeled, if
right.
You use that term.
And again, we've looked into, and people who worked off the clock exceeded the pharmacy maximum hours, and we provided that analysis to the district court below. And that was to show that we weren't adding any facts. We weren't changing the factual predicate.
So just the bottom line, your argument is they should have intervened when they found out in January of 2019?
Correct. With the substantial overlap, they should have made attempts to intervene at that point.
What about the fact that it was dismissed at that point? The PAGA claims were dismissed at that point.
Still, the Chalian case had the class action overlap part, right? That still existed. The Cabrera class claim still existed at that point. The facts are the same, right? We're talking about pharmacists working off the clock, not getting meal and rest periods. Those are indicias of things that say, hey, this case is like mine. Let me reach out to them and work with them. To Mr. Boudreau.
Well, it's not a trick clock. That's the amount of time left cumulatively. So, to be clear.
All right. First, the Cabrera claims weren't dismissed. They were on appeal. The PAGA claims were on appeal.
The summary judgment had been granted. We get the verb.
Right.
Go right ahead.
I just want to make sure that's clear. They were out there with Kim V. Rhines hanging in the shadow. But it seems that there is an effort here to make this appeal or appeals something bigger than it is. These are not the appropriate vehicles, I think, to be addressing these incredible questions of PAGA and all this kind of thing. There's far more simpler, rational ways. The first appeal is a Rule 24A appeal. There's a Rule 24A, four factors. The district court found intervention was improper based on precedent. Since the district court's ruling, it's been approved by this court, that rationale. Secondly, taking apart the Harvey v. Morgan Stanley case that said no substantive interest in PAGA claims, you can't intervene. The third prong of intervention as of right Callahan addresses that.
But you keep mentioning cases that have been, they're either on one or the other side of a split, or that there have been other cases that suggest that those principles have been eroded, and you know that. So I don't want to use all 2 minutes of your time, but surely you're aware of that.
But that's not the issue here. The issue is the interest.
Right.
And the reality is everyone is conflating the right to litigate a PAGA claim with the right to settle one. And the Acevedo case that just came down.
Unpublished.
September,
I've got it right here.
Yep.
Yep.
Basically said, in that case, that these are not jurisdictional prerequisites. They're procedural prerequisites, which then obviously means defendants can waive them, they can do what they want. And the bottom line is there's a litany of cases in which PAGA claims have been roped in or other claims that have been roped in without exhaustion that have been part of settlements. And so then we get to this Rule 23 settlement. They appeal the PAGA portion of it, but Cecilia B. Peck, you know, forecloses that appeal. They don't have an ability to appeal it unless you create an exception that permits non-parties to appeal. And there's absolutely no basis for that exception.
Exceptional circumstances.
Exceptional circumstances, but a sure number of these cases would probably warrant a finding that it's clearly not exceptional circumstances. I mean, in the last year alone, there's been four or five of these opinions. It's going to open floodgates to PAGA appeals. You know, you think you've got a lot of them now, you got this one, there's going to be 50 more tomorrow. You know, and so ultimately,
inherently exceptional for a party that can't bring a claim to settle and exclude from participation a party, the only party that can bring the claim.
But the statutory scheme actually provides for that. PAGA has no notice requirement to whether to claim it or anything. It has it to the LWDA. That's it. Nobody has to inform anyone of
a settlement. And we don't need to wait for Turrieta?
Excuse me?
Is your position that we should not wait for Turrieta?
You should not wait for Turrieta simply because I think that the issues involved here, Rule 24A, federal rule, and these are all rules of federal class action.
All depend upon the nature of the right.
But that's pretty well decided now. Turrieta could certainly change that. But there's a bevy of very recent precedent in both the lower courts and this court that show no signs or a need to wait. But what nobody's actually, I've noticed in this appeal, is turned to is the actual fairness of the settlement and the job that the district court did to assure that it was fair and reasonable. He created the process that he went through to both comply with the law and issue rulings, and at the same time...
Wait, you're talking about the merits now.
No, we're talking about the merits, yes.
The merits of the actual, yeah, which this appeal is actually about.
If we get to the merits, $300 per class member, less than 5% of what the parties, the settling parties' own expert valued the claims at. It strikes me there are questions to be raised. $75,000 on the PAGA.
I think the thing in this appeal that's most striking from reading the fairness aspects of the brief, you know, that kind of stuff, is the opening brief in this appeal, which never mentions probably the most salient fact to the value of the claims, and that is that 98% of the people are subject to arbitration agreements.
I never understood that point in the brief. I suppose all of us as in practice had arbitrations, and typically the plaintiffs get or claimants get some money in arbitration, often more than is predicted for litigation, because the arbitrators are more sophisticated and can sometimes see past problems the jury would have. And it seems like you're saying all claims to be arbitrated should be valued at zero, and I just don't understand why.
I don't think that's what it is. It is that the idea that you're going to have the agglomeration of 24,000 claims in arbitration is not going to happen.
What typically happens when you have a whole lot of possible claimants and you don't have a class action is three or four or a half dozen get litigated, and then the rest settle along the lines that the litigation came out at. That's typical. I mean,
but that requires
with products defects litigation, it happens all the time.
And that requires industrious lawyers to sign up claimants that are truly interested in the action enough to bring the individual claim,
which happens all the time.
I wouldn't say it happens all the time.
Could you wrap up, please?
Again, I just want to take us back to what this appeal is about and the fact that Cecilio forecloses any attack on the PAGA case. And the Rule 23 component, I guess we'll discuss a little bit more in the next one. But I think the record reflects an incredibly industrious approach to approving and evaluating the settlement that certainly does not manifest any abuse of discretion.
Thank you.
Thank you. I would like to address some of the things that have been stated by the other counsel in this case. Number one, to get back to the point about the LWGA having the right to involve itself, but the proxy not having the right to involve itself on behalf of the state. We did cite in our papers a reference to the evidence where the LWDA specifically sent an email to counsel in this case saying, we expect you as our proxy to be the ones who would object to the settlement or intervene on our behalf. We do not have the resources to do it. They referred us to the budget resolution. So I want to call the court's attention to that. I also would like to call the court's attention to the fact that the case of Magadia in this circuit says that it is a complete assignment to the proxy, and therefore that addresses Mr. Morrison's point that the LWDA somehow retains some sort of ability to intervene. It was, according to this circuit, the law in this circuit, it's a complete assignment once there is a proxy. I'd also like to call the court's attention to the Howitzin case, which we have cited in our papers.
What's Howitzin?
It goes through a claim preclusion analysis. It's a state court case, and it talks about, first and foremost, I want to call the court's attention to the fact that this idea of an identical factual predicate, that's something that arises in the context of class actions. It is not something that is appropriate in the PAGA context. In the PAGA context, it is important to have the pre-filing notice. That is very clear for California law.
That's sort of an outgrowth of what I was saying. This district court judge didn't have the benefit of Muniz, right? That's why his order says it therefore follows that. I mean, he was trying to sort of predict how this is going to go. But I think your point's well taken.
Okay. So, and anyway, about the about the identical factual predicate, I'd like to call the court's attention to the PAGA letters that were submitted. They're at 21 ER 4569 to 4574. The court can look at those and determine whether there's anything in there that is a fact or a theory that is related to the Hyams-only claims. We think that it's pretty clear from the letters that it's not. The idea of praying claim preclusion, it does not apply to matters that could not have been raised or litigated in an earlier action. Here, it's our theory that because they weren't noticed, they couldn't be litigated, and therefore they're not subject to the claim preclusion doctrine. In addition, in this circuit, the primary rights doctrine distinguishes between wage claims and non-wage claims, and it says they arise from the different primary rights. We have argued in our papers, and we argue here, that the claims that may have been overlapping in the PAGA claims, in the PAGA notices, those were wage claims. The Hyams-only claims are non-wage claims. They do not involve the same primary right for the reasons I've already given the court. The citation for that is Magana versus Zara Inc., or Zara USA Inc. The Howitzin case goes through the claim preclusion analysis in the context of whether an individual or the state in a PAGA case have the same primary right, and it says the state's primary right is different from an individual's primary right. What we're saying in this case is that Hyams is the only one who has the state's right, and therefore his primary right as the proxy of the state is totally different than any other right that could be asserted by anybody who was not a proxy. And I would also just like to correct a few things that I think were misstatements about the...
Out of time, so you're going to have to wrap up.
Okay. I want to make the point that in the notice of related cases, we argued in the Hyams case that our case was different because our case had these Hyams-only labor code claims that were pocket claims. That was the purpose of saying that the cases were different. And when they became conflated, that was the problem. This is not about hard feelings. We have a lot of class members who have said to us, this is not fair, this doesn't serve our purposes, and we're trying to stand up on their behalf and on behalf of the state. Thank you.
Thank you all for your argument. Would you like to take a quick break?
Whatever you like.
I'm good. Okay, we'll go on to the next case on the calendar then.